podcast, I will be talking with people who share their stories of tragedy and of hope. I will be exploring mental health and well-being with workplace professionals and also with folk who have struggled to make sense of their own lives. My hope is that these shared experiences will remove the loneliness from those people who are convinced it is their fate to suffer alone. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been a serving police officer for over 20 years. You are very welcome to join me on Walk the Talk. My guest today has asked to remain anonymous for no other reason than to protect the identities of those people involved. He was responsible for a serious assault that resulted in a lengthy jail sentence. Whilst inside, through the 12-step program, he closely examined himself and looked at his actions and how they were influenced by his own childhood experiences of abuse and his subsequent addiction to alcohol and cocaine. He describes his rehabilitation through to recovery as brutal, and it has not been an easy journey. What has struck me with this man is his honesty, in which he has looked at himself without pity, and the gratitude he now feels every morning as he wakes up not needing a drink. I'm delighted to say he joins me now. My guest today has previously served an 8-year prison sentence for a serious assault. He is asked to remain anonymous to protect the identities of those involved. Welcome to Walk the Talk. Are you able to share with me what led to that sentence?
Yes, good morning. What led to the sentence? I sort of like split up from my partner at the time and was living on my own. We had a little boy and I was working. I was drinking in the evenings, isolating quite a lot, drinking on my own. And it was a difficult, it was a bit of a difficult time coming to terms with the loss of a partner who I was married to, and not seeing my boy, little boy, so often. And things just got on top with what I thought at the time, the way he's being treated emotionally. I ended up, due to intolerance really from my own childhood, taking the law into my own hands and harming two people that I thought at the time were harming him emotionally. What led me to it? Not reaching out for help, I guess. I tried to reach out for help with children's services. I mean, at the end of the day, there'll never be any excuse, justification or defence for my actions that evening. But I was told in prison after 2 or 3 years from someone that major contribution towards my offence was cognitive errors for me, overthinking errors, in particular emotional reasoning. And this was made a lot worse by using alcohol, because that distorted my thinking even further. Well, I didn't realise at the time that alcohol was a depressant, and when I drank, I used to catastrophise about what was happening. It made the situation worse and made my emotional reasoning. Emotional reason is where you feel you're doing the right thing and you're not thinking about the consequences and you're driven by your emotions.
Up until that point, I suppose, you led a pretty ordinary life like the rest of us. It was, of course, a change dramatically. Perhaps you could share the transition of that life to one where your freedom was deprived.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of most youngsters of my age growing up in the 70s, sort of like drink socially, go down the pub, whatever, not really an issue, really. But then in my late teens, I got in trouble with the police, getting into a fight outside a pub. Obviously, it wasn't good. Alcohol was involved. About a month later, I lost my driving licence after having it for 3 months, so I say if you could look in reflection, the writing was on the wall that I had a problem with alcohol. I didn't used to drink that much, and that was one of the things that I never thought I had a problem with, because my friends used to drink more. I used to drink 2 or 3 pints, they could drink 5 or 6 pints. You know, hoy, I haven't got a problem. As I went into my 20s and 30s, I began to drink more, or more often. Somewhere along the line, my drinking changed from wanting a drink to needing a drink, and or some sort of dependency came in. I got divorced when I was 40 from my first marriage, and I went on a bit of a midlife crisis, if you like. Got involved with the wrong people, or at the time I thought they were nice people. Used to do cocaine, I did my first line of cocaine when I was 44. Over that sort of period, what I realised was, and I did at that stage, is that everything I'd ever felt guilty about or got in trouble with the police all happened after I'd been drinking too much alcohol. It wouldn't be until a lot later that I was able to process why I drank and the reasons for it.
Once you did go to jail, I mean, I suppose on a physical aspect, all that addiction would have to stop. How did you deal with that?
Well, just before that, interestingly, I started taking cocaine when I was 44 and had drunk previously before that. And I could never drink that much. But with cocaine, I was able to drink more because cocaine was a bit of a leveller. When my little boy was quite young, social services were involved, and they basically gave me an ultimatum that I used to just use cocaine recreationally. Complete denial of whatever, and they actually said they were going to give me a hair strand test, so which is serious stuff. You can't lie anymore for that. So I give up cocaine about a year before I went into prison, and I thought I was actually giving up the thing that was causing the issue. What I know now, it wasn't my drug of choice. My drug of choice is alcohol. But I kept, whilst I stopped taking cocaine, I carried on drinking. And I found that I was becoming more unmanageable again.
So addiction all too often plays a part in these situations, and you were no different. You've obviously mentioned some of the things that you were addicted to. How did those addictions come about?
What I learned about drinking is initially it changed the way I felt due to my childhood. I had a pretty chaotic childhood, troubled childhood. I mean, I was sort of hit by my mum when I was 8 years old. Time my biological father left because of my mum's drinking with huge abandonment issues. I had to live with my nan and granddad, who wouldn't let me see my father because of my nan's views about him. And I was sort of like sexually abused when I was about 11, beaten up by my stepfather when I was quite young as well. I was the first one to see my mum after she'd tried to commit suicide, and while she's in hospital, I was made to look after my three younger siblings.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 10. Yeah. I found my mum unconscious in the front garden, and I was forced to cook for my brothers when I was 10 years old and look after them. My mother died when I was 31 due to alcohol. You know, and I didn't really suffer that much grief because I had sort of like resented her at the time I blamed her for the loss of my father because of her drinking. What I know now is I used to drink to escape from that pain, to hide it.
How old was it when you started drinking? Can you remember?
Yeah, about 14, 15. I was going down to pubs in those days, back in the 70s. You could probably have a couple of pints in the pub, go in the garden, someone a bit older would go and get the pints, drive out to a pub.
So do you think that was all about trying to deal with what was going on, or not coping with what was...
No, that was just social. That was social. That was just the thing to do in those days.
I'm just interested how you mentioned the experiences when you were 10, which is a very young age to have to deal with those adult problems. How you coped with those?
It's an interesting point, actually, because I always thought, or was told, that if your mum and dad drunk, you were more likely to drink. There is some truth to that, but I've learned from my sponsor a lot of the cases, and for myself, it's about coping mechanisms that are developed during that time. For example, with myself, with the chaos that was going home with my mum's drinking, I actually used to go around or avoid the situation by, or as a coping strategy, used to go in my friend's house most evenings, or I used to go and watch my favourite football team play, and I used to travel up to London. I also started playing a lot of table tennis, like almost obsessively in the evenings to get out of the house. So if you like, I sort of developed some coping strategies. Young learnt coping strategies as a 10, 11, 12 year old to cope or distract myself from those things. Because of them early techniques learnt, when one becomes, you know, mid-teens, late teens, and alcohol and whatever, and maybe drugs come available, once you're of the age where you can try them, they become an easier distraction to cope with your feelings. So there is a correlation, if you like, in a relationship between early learned behaviours for coping and later addiction, because there are sort of addictions in different things. While one's perhaps a little bit healthier when you're younger, but when you get older, then obviously the substances become more prevalent.
I'm just wondering as well, because at 10, you're not really in a position to confront the problem head on, are you? So, you know, as you've alluded to, I suppose you're almost escaping the problem, unable to cope with it. I'm wondering if those problems that you suffered as an earlier child and came back to haunt you later on in life.
Yes, definitely, of course. I'm the oldest, and my younger siblings are, when I was 10, my siblings were 7, 5, 4, 3. When I was looking after my brothers on my own, I had an experience where I was locked in my room, or we were locked in the room, while my 5-year-old brother was beaten all night by a violent stepfather. Wouldn't let him go to school for 3 weeks. He was black and blue. That will come to haunt me and shape me for the rest of my life with regard to inappropriate blaming for not being able to do anything about it, and just gave me such a strong intolerance towards any form of abuse towards children, because whether it's physical or whether it's sexual, it always ends up, in my opinion, as emotional abuse, because people carry forward the trauma from that event. So it always ends up being a long-term, potentially a long-term emotional impact on people.
How old were you when you experienced that, when your brother was being beaten?
I was 10 years old.
Again, not in a position to do much about it.
I did confront my father, who was 18 stone. I was beaten in the garage but I had 3 younger brothers that I loved and a younger sister, and I felt a responsibility. I'd always lived in a nice house, nice countryside. After my father left, we were put into hostel. We ended up in a really rough council estate in South London. I guess because I was the oldest, I felt responsibility and a duty of care to my younger brothers. Which in some ways, from a duty care point of view, has always been very strong in some ways. But when I say that, I don't want to be hypocritical, because when I had children myself, I was irresponsible and put alcohol before the needs of my children, for sure, emotionally. It's true, you hear people say, I'd do anything for my children, I love my children. Okay, I love my children, but unfortunately I loved alcohol more. And that is a fact. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had such hangovers in the morning, not be able to go out.
And we're going to talk about your recovery in a moment, but I still detect a lot of guilt in your voice. And is that something that's a barrier to moving forward, perhaps?
Well, let's start on the positive side of things. I think it's always good. What they say in recovery is you can't always close the door on the path, but you must move on from it. In other words, that means when you do step one, where you look at your powerless and unmanageability, you must always be aware of the harm and the emotional pain you cause to other people whilst you're using. But nevertheless, if you carry that guilt, then you're more likely to use again to change the way you feel, which is like a revolving door, if you like. So, but you have to learn that what's happened, accept what's happened, happened, and you have to move on. You know, the best way I've been able to move on is to have a very good look at myself. And in prison, I was able to, if you could imagine like an old classic car that someone buys, old being probably me, in as much that you bring a car in, you strip it down to the chassis, then you put bits back together again. And I think that would be the best way to describe and come out the other end. So, yeah, that has helped repair through the guidance of very good psychologists in prison who have looked. For example, I did my six-month substance misuse program in prison, which is pretty harsh, to be honest with you, and pretty brutal. I don't mean brutal in the physical sense, but I mean brutal in as much that when you read out the examples of some of your, to your peers, of some of the things you've done, how you felt about it then, how about it now. If you don't really choke up, right, they'll think you're minimising.
Yeah? Right.
If that's the best you can do, is that...
Is this your peers thinking that?
And the focal counsellors as well, your counsellors in there as well. So you get very good feedback, and they're not to dig you out, they're just to make you dig a bit deeper. So that's just one example, but there's been lots of other things where a couple of years after that I did a another program where one of the psychologists said to me, or I said to one of the psychologists, well, everything I've ever done in the past, well, you know, whatever, has been to do with, you know, all to do with alcohol. So basically, if I stop drinking alcohol, it's not going to happen again. He said, whoa. Alcohol is only the enabler. It's your thinking. And it took me a few days to process that. And I very much get that, because it's in the thinking. Because there's lots of things I thought about, but I'd only carry them out if I drank alcohol. And if I hadn't drunk alcohol, arguably, I wouldn't have carried them out. So it was the drinking that made me unmanageable.
But then that leads you to, why were you thinking? What were you thinking, I suppose? Oh,
that's a bigger question. Yeah, that is due to a lot of resentments I held, a lot of fears I held, a lot of intolerances I held about life, about from life events that had never really been explored to me, but they were explored during the two programs. I mean, for example, I never had spoken to really anyone about sexual abuse to anyone until I was in prison, and I was given a really good booklet on, which again changed things. It wasn't victims of male sexual abuse, it was survivors of male sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And that changed it around, because I'd always felt guilty for that, as if it was my fault, you know, so on and so forth. So that's just one example. Yeah. Another great example, very famous guy, Terry Waite, comes into a lot of prisons. He did a chair and a question and answer session afterwards. And one of the famous things he has said is that bitterness is a cancer, so it causes more harm to those who hold it than who it's held against.
Yes.
And that really was something very powerful for me.
Now, of course, this is Terry Waite that was...
This is, Terry...
Envoy that was kidnapped.
And he was able to forgive his... that was really empowering thing for someone to say, because I realised that sometimes when I was pacing up and down my cell at night, or that sort of thing, with what I wanted time to do to them, or that sort of stuff, or an anger towards anything, it was actually me, the person I was harming. I wasn't actually harming the other person, I was harming myself. And it wasn't doing me any good. So there had to be serious changes there, where I had to, which I'll get help later on during the programme.
you very nicely brought me on to the next question, and you have covered it, I suppose. But obviously in these podcasts, we're going to be exploring adverse childhood experiences, and perhaps we could just look a bit more into that. And what have you discovered?
Well, it's been mainly through the steps, really.
So just explain that then for people.
Well, basically, when you do the steps, it's a basic part. It's all part of the 12-step program that's involved in the AA fellowship. For anyone who's listening, who's not familiar with it, AA is just like a fellowship and organization that's confidential. You keep anonymous and you go along to meetings with like-minded people.
Because people think it's God-driven, and it's not that at all.
No. It's a spiritual program. Mm. Some people are put off initially because they may be agnostic and so on and so forth, and get put off by the word God. At the end of the day, when they say God, it's really you're talking about a higher power, and a higher power can be anything that can be important to you. My higher power is the steps themselves. Mm. One of the reasons why in early recovery I had a few problems, because I was agnostic, and people used to say to me, well, you know, you came to believe in step two that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. And they said, well, God's going to stop you drinking. And I thought to myself, well, if you think if I'm going to go back in a... I'm in a bar and I've got a pint of a San Miguel on there, if you think God's going to come through the thing and take that out of my hand, I said, you're having a laugh. The only person that's going to stop that is me.
Yeah.
It has to come from within.
And it sounds quite a brutal journey, to be honest.
People say it's a brutal journey. Basically, very simply, step one is looking at your powerless and unmanageability, which looks at how you are not able to stop drinking and what happens when you do and you manage your police. Step two is basically about showing that you haven't been able to do it on your own, which is evidence based on either your criminal record or some of the events you've done in the past. Step three is making a decision to seek support and how you're going to do it. And the important ones, which you just mentioned there, is about step four and step you touch on, are really step four and five on some of the things through childhood that developed in writing lists of, you know, resentment, some of your assets, stuff like that, detailed lists of things that, you know, you have self defects in. Then five is about speaking to them, to share them with another human being. The sort of things in that really quite, in my case, the self-defects, a lot of my self-defects, or some of my self-defects, primarily are intolerance. Intolerance being disagreeing, or that's not the right thing, or intolerance of people's behaviour, actions, the way they do things. Intellectual pride in thinking that I know better than everyone else. Mm-hmm. It's like my way or the highway. Fears was a big one for me. There's also grandiosity, stuff like that. There's ego, which is another huge one for people, that, you know, not wanting to accept criticism or doing things so they're the best and whatever. And
with that wonderful lens of hindsight in mind, what would you tell yourself back then? What remains for you to do?
Step eight, my step nine with my sponsor. That was a big turning point for me. Because there's a long list of, I had to make a long list or a list of all the people I had harmed in my life, physically, emotionally, whatever. And there was a long list. The best way I can make amends to all of them is not to drink anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't harm anyone else. So, or harm them again. So that was a big start. Obviously, step nine is making amends, direct or indirect amends, where possible, where to do so wouldn't harm them. I've been able to do a lot of that by my actions, by being a good role model father again, being there for my older children, and the way I carry myself as a good example to other people in recovery. I do voluntary work. I also work in a rehabilitation centre now, helping people in recovery. And yeah, that's what I can put back. I'm working for an organisation where they see the person irrespective of anything else, and it's a journey. Everyone's journey, history or past is different, but a lot of people end up in the same place, in the same rooms, for a common identity. It's progress, not perfection. And you take one day at a time, but and recovery is good. And if it wasn't that good, I'd go back to drinking.
Mm. I've been thinking about this interview for a few days, and I read something last night which really hit me. You may have heard of this. This person said, "We must embrace pain and burn it as fuel for our journey."
Yes, but yeah, I agree with that. You mentioned about the pain earlier of the programme, and yes, step one can be very painful in being honest about the harm you've caused to people. Steps 6 and 7 are not painful, but they're very much the growth steps when you look at your defects, be aware of them, and so you're mindful of them. And 7, obviously, not to throw your toys out the pram. But when you come to steps 8 and 9, on all those steps, they become, the important part of the program is the self-repair process of the program, where you open up all those wounds from the past in the first few steps and you take that on board. But it's so important that you continue, because those the rest of the steps, 6 to 12, are, if you like, the growth steps, where you actually get that self-repair of being good and just leading your life like you perhaps should have led your life before alcohol or drugs destroyed and had such a huge impact on your job, your family, your finances, your children.
So I suppose it's important that part of that journey is to stop using pain as a fuel and
if you don't get the pain out and you hold it, you can use again. You have to really, really dig deep when you do your step 4. I mean, I did step 4 and 5 in prison.
Yeah.
And it was like a 50%, 60% effort in there. I did it again with my sponsor, who is absolutely brilliant, and we went a lot deeper.
Because the fear could be that you get rid of that pain and it leaves a vacuum, and what do you fill it with?
As you know, there was a lot of as I said, I had to dig very deep into my past, and particularly my childhood. But how I've been able to move on is resolving that childhood trauma, because if I'd carried on, if it hadn't been resolved, I would say with some degree of certainty that I'd have gone back to drinking, because I can't help other people if I can't help myself.
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm still carrying those resentments. I fill it with leading a healthy lifestyle as opposed to an unhealthy lifestyle. With regard to, I have healthy relationships. I don't have intimate relationships with women, I like women to be friends, because what's suggested in the first few years of sobriety that we don't have emotional trauma or any emotions affect, because probably a lot of people might identify that if they feel down about a relationship ends, you know, there's possible drink or have a drink to cope with their emotions and feeling sad and so on and so forth. So that's, but like doing health things, keeping myself fit, I now be able to see my children, and I don't have to get away quickly because I need to get to the pub or anything like that. I don't have to drink and drive anymore. Worry about, you know, that blue flashing light coming on or whatever. And more important than anything is, this is quite interesting, I woke up in prison about 2 years after I'd been in prison. And the prison where I was in the countryside, and it was in the summer, and I woke up about 5 o'clock and I could hear the cows in the field outside. And I was out of bed and I was happy, and I could not work out why I was happy. And what dawned on me while I was drinking my coffee was I'd actually realised that I'd woken up without any guilt or shame of actually harming anyone the night before, emotionally or physically or whatever. I hadn't sent any abusive texts. You know, I hadn't woken up with cigarette burns on the floor and a bottle of vodka rolling on thing and, you know, my head banging and loads of missed calls and have to work out what I did in my blackout. And to wake up without that feeling, it suddenly dawned on me, this is like a new dawn of recovery. This is what it is. It's like a freedom from that guilt. And one of the things that stops me drinking tonight, or will stop me drinking tonight, is I want to wake up tomorrow morning with the same feeling.
It's almost like a weight being lifted off you.
Some people think that, I used to think, God, I'd never be able to enjoy life without a drink, or, you know, it'd be funny with women without a line of coke or something like that.
You've been telling me about your recovery and you've been smiling like, well, grinning, not smiling like a Cheshire cat. So I think you're doing great works, and I wish you well on your own road.
Thank you very much for your time this morning.